Hello everyone. This is Nupur Ray from India, and we are here today with our third podcast episode of a series that we are doing on gender-based violence for collaborative social change. And it's an honor and a privilege that we have with us Emily Sample today to discuss, to kind of make us aware of looking at gender-based violence in the context of climate change. Before we begin this conversation with Emily, I would like to introduce her to our audience today. Emily is a program director at Fund for Peace and a PhD candidate at the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter School for Peace and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. Her most recent work, Building Peace in America, was published in August 2020. She's also worked as an Associate Director of Education at Holocaust Museum Houston and for the International Conference on the Great Lakes Region, Uganda National Committee on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide and Mass Atrocities. She has extensively been working and writing in areas of peace building, climate change adaptation, environmental justice, gender, and mass atrocity prevention. It is such a pleasure to have you with us, Emily. In the first episode, we look at some of the basic ideas around gender-based violence. In the second episode, we looked at gender-based violence in the context of India, and specifically more in terms of sexual and reproductive rights for women in India. So we are glad that now we are today adding a new leaf to this series, and you are here to discuss something very important as well as something which do not really kind of come together for many of the scholars, that how these two issues, which in themselves are such, such challenges when we are looking at gender-based violence and when we are looking at climate change, both in their own spaces are major challenges. But what is very important here in terms of scholarship and in terms of looking at implications is how they come together and how they impact each other and perhaps how they intensify implications, you know, on women and young girls. So, to begin with, please take us through that, a bit of historical trajectory as well as some kind of academic scholarship where you can share your views around looking at gender-based violence in the context of climate change.
Well, I just want to start with, I am so grateful to be here and thank you so much for the invitation to join this discussion today. This is such an important conversation, looking at all the different ways that gender-based violence intersects with every other part of our society and especially with every aspect of peace building. So I really appreciate you hosting this conversation, both today and the ones in the past and in the future. So one of the ways that I like to think about this issue, because they do seem in many ways like two different circles that don't necessarily overlap, I like to start by kind of tracing out some of the ways that we intersect gender-based violence and climate change, and even more broadly, environmental issues, before going into the structural issues, but instead looking at the very physical manifestations of this kind of violence. So first and foremost, women and girl children especially are overwhelmingly in charge of food resources worldwide, because of the societal hegemonies that are global, under global patriarchy. The women are socialized in almost every society to be in charge of food resources, and that goes from the women who are gathering food and water and firewood in Uganda, which is where most of my research has taken place so far, to the women in my own community. My mother does all of the cooking in our house. I think my dad, every once in a while, will throw together some spaghetti. But overwhelmingly, she is in charge of not only the meal planning, but also the grocery shopping and the cooking. And so it is important that we recognize that this is a global issue. This is not something that is only affecting women in the global South. This is not something that is only affecting women in areas who are working on, who are living under subsistence farming. This is something where women globally are in charge of the grocery bill, while women overwhelmingly are not in charge of the family finances. Or the land ownership, the legal land ownership. So what we're seeing is women who are in charge of trying to plan and adapt to the family nutrition needs without being necessarily given the ability and the capital to adapt to the needs under climate change. So especially right now, I'm thinking especially of the United States, where we have extremely high inflation going on right now, due in part to COVID and other shortages on, in the supply chain. Women are going to the grocery store and are not able to get the same kind of nutrition or caloric value out of food for the price. So if they are working under a household budget, there are cuts being made. And this is happening worldwide. So that is, you know, if you're looking at women in urban structures who are trying to manage the family's nutrition systems, in an urban space where they're buying food, not growing it, climate change is still affecting this issue. And if women are coming home and are either able to, unable to manage the family finances, and increase the grocery budget or balance that budget with other things, or are having to go without food themselves, or who are facing violence when they are asking their partners to adapt the family budget, who may not be willing to change the budget. And there is gender-based violence happening, domestic violence happening, where women are unable to change the grocery budget to accommodate for our increased inflation rates. In areas that are more dependent on subsistence farming, we see women having to adapt to planting and water shortages, or planting season changes and water shortages, whereas they were previously able to anticipate certain weather patterns. Due to climate change, those weather patterns are changing, or there is an increase or in the intensity and the frequency of a disastrous weather event, such as a sudden drought or a flood or something like typhoons and hurricanes. We're seeing an increase in both the frequency and the intensity, and that is chalked up to climate change. So people who are losing their entire seed crops because they were previously able to plant after a certain date, and then that crop is getting frozen or that crop is getting washed away in an unanticipated change in weather patterns, or those seeds that they had been planting for generations are no longer able to adapt to the level of toxification in the soil or the level of the reduced level of water availability. So those seeds are no longer thriving in a place that they used to be viable. So we're seeing those changes that women are being having are who are in charge of food, having to make those changes without necessarily having the capital or the education or the freedom to make those changes for their families. So that is just on a very like base level that I think everyone can connect to. We all eat. We all have to provide food for our families. We all know our mother's cooking. You know, we all have that kind of connection to food, or almost all of us have that connection to food that we have to acknowledge is changing, and on a very basic level.
Yeah, thank you, Emily. I think there are layers in our conversation that just happened. Like, A, you looked at circumstances where the climate change is there, and how gradually, perhaps not in a very explicit manner, how those changes are impacting the way that women are accessing the resources, and there is a shortage of resources, and how that is leading to different forms of violence against them. The other situation that you discuss is in terms of extreme disaster. When it just hits a community. Like, for example, I was reading a report that happened in Bangladesh, and where because of extreme climate change, and maybe I think there was drought, and because of that there was acute shortage of food and water, and that actually led to a lot of young girls being forced into marriage in other areas. So that is why. And the other thing that you also brought out very articulately are the layers of violence itself. So how physical violence is one form of violence which is easily acknowledgeable, and it is something which can be seen, but how when we are looking at those interconnections between gender-based violence and climate change, what I can understand here is that those more implicit forms of violence, whether it is psychological, whether it is in form of deprivation, whether it is in form of fear or threat, that constantly can impact women, in terms of how they access the resources and how they manage. So then, if we can take this issue further, and you did bring about the very important observation about that, how it is not a global problem, how it may vary, sorry, how it is a global problem, and how it may vary in terms of regional differences, but it is something that is there in terms of all, mostly, largely at a global level. But if we may still look into something that the world just been through, and which is COVID, and then is there any specific observation, or is there any specific study that you would like to share, or observations that you have, where actually the forms of violence, and looking at climate change and health risk because of COVID, has come together, and it has further created layers of oppression, for women.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head there, where these things are layering on top of each other, in terms of just creating circumstances where the structural pressures are increasing from every side. And one of the things that we do that is considered a huge issue that is more a structural form of gender-based violence, but is a well-noted form of gender-based violence, is early marriages, forced prostitution, forced pregnancy, and some of these major issues that are coming out of a response of poverty. So people who are facing especially food shortages, who are unable because of the aforementioned disasters, who are unable to grow their own food, or who are unable to afford the prices at the market, or who are unable to sell their own food at a market. Again, looking at that compounding pressure of COVID, if markets are closed, people can't sell their goods, and then the food rots. Right, so both food insecurity from people not being able to access food, but people also not being able to sell the food that they've grown. And that results in many families having to make the difficult choice of having one of their girl children married to a family that either provides them with a bride price and is able to give them some financial relief, or if nothing else, removes one mouth from the family necessity to feed. right? So women are, and girl children especially, are being moved out of the family through forced marriages, through early marriages, under the age of 16. And that is resulting in increased what we consider forced pregnancy, and these compounding issues of violence. And so both forced marriage and forced pregnancy are considered, of course, a form of violence. So and those are noted results of poverty issues, and those poverty issues are coming about through food insecurity, as well as water insecurity in many places.
Thank you very much. The other concern that comes when we are looking at climate change and violence is migration. So yes, one is that of course there is certain kind of deprivation and violence that women are facing in their native community. But then it comes to a point where a lot of communities are required to then migrate. How do you see the nature of violence and the kind of challenges that women face in that space, because of the climate change?
Yeah, so migration itself is a multi-pronged issue for gender-based violence, and so the first issue is that you often see women unable to migrate. So you will often see women being the head of household because all of the men in the family have left to try and increase their financial opportunities and their economic opportunities, and they may or may not be sending money home. So they have lost the male side of their family. This is a definitely a gender-based issue, not only for the women, but for the men who are forced to leave. And this extremely dangerous migration for many people, because for many people, and I'm thinking especially of some of the countries in West Africa who are facing the desertification of their agricultural zones, they are forced to take extremely dangerous human trafficking routes up through North Africa, to Europe to try and find work. And so this is a gender-based issue, looking at the intense need and the pressure on men to provide for their families, even when that can lead to death. And then on the other side, women who are unable to migrate, despite the fact that their homes and their land may no longer be arable, so they may no longer have the access to the kinds of seeds or the water that is ne necessary to feed their families, and they don't have any source of income besides farming, and but they're unable to migrate either due to the fact that they are caring for multiple people in the family, or because the family has no financial means, and they are forced then into something like a human trafficking in order to pay for migration. On the other side of this as well, there are issues in host communities where we see migrants gathering. So I'm thinking specifically of some countries in West Africa like Mali, or Southeast Asia like Bangladesh, as you noted, where we have this intense urbanization, as people are moving out of the country and into the city looking for economic opportunity. And there is a host of localized environmental issues. And those should be considered under the large umbrella of climate change. They are not necessarily the what we think of as like the CO2 emissions level global climate change, but rather localized, the change to your localized climate. And I'm thinking of issues of intense acute desertification due to deforestation and soil erosion in areas where there has been, for example, IDP camps coming in, refugee camps, where there is a small population. And then it is suddenly increased to a million people, for example, in the camps around in Bangladesh or in Bidi Bidi Camp in Uganda, or in some of the camps in Turkey, where you would then have a massive swelling of humans who need not only things like wood for cooking, but are also needing water that you can't truck in that much water necessarily. And there's also an issue of human waste removal. And so you have issues of local climatic change where you have massive human waste and pollution. I'm thinking of like litter and plastic and those, thousands of jerry cans, where they are all being suddenly in one place that has no infrastructure for sewage and garbage removal. So these things are building up and toxifying the local area. So, for example, if you do have a water source, how is the human waste removal and in many cases the animal waste removal? Because a lot of these places are host. Which I think is a good thing, are host to small livestock like goats and chickens. But their waste also needs to be removed away from water sources. Otherwise, we do have these massive outbreaks of things like dysentery, of cholera, of typhoid, as they are simply unable to keep the water sources clean in areas of massive urbanization. So this is happening both in IDP camps, refugee camps, but also in some of these big cities where the urbanization has happened so fast that instead that there has not been enough time or capital to build housing and infrastructure for people. So you have a but informal housing that is not necessarily safely wired for electricity, but is also not necessarily have things like waste removal, water sources, the infrastructure for trash removal, and all of these things impact us in a gendered way because, for example, women are cooking at gas stoves or charcoal stoves inside of these houses that do not have proper ventilation or don't have proper electricity. So they are at a massive risk of not only internal air pollutants, but also of fires, of course. And then you also have issues of rape. And violence against women within these informal spaces, as well as prostitution as a form of survival. So all of these issues are compounding on each other. And as you said before, where COVID comes in, and all of these people are living in close quarters to one another, and there isn't proper waste removal. All of these things then compound each other as well.
Thank you so much for again unpacking, what we could see as multiple forms of vulnerabilities, that women face. And again, in your discussion, at this point, again, something which perhaps gets kind of not ignored, but it comes later in terms of the discussion itself, is general health of women. So, we are looking at sexual and reproductive health. We're also looking at in terms of what are their access to what is called as a health environment. Like, for example, you mentioned about, if there is no proper waste removal thing and the informal housing and women are actually cooking in the house, then how safe it is for them in the longer run? Or for example, if the due to shortage of water, if young women and girls have to walk and walk longer distances to access food, to access fuel, to access water, it does definitely make them more vulnerable to any kind of violence, but it also in the longer run impacts their health, their
Absolutely.
Home, their physical. So if you could just throw some light. Yes. If you could just throw some light in terms of the generic health, indicators where women become much more vulnerable, whether it could be, especially in terms of sexual and reproductive health, it could be access to abortion, safe abortion services, it could be in terms of their fertility choices, it could be in terms of just, you know, their access to nutrition, especially during pregnancy. Is there other reports or any observations that you have?
Yeah. So you are absolutely correct in noting that this issue for women who have to walk for food, water, and energy resources is a major aspect of this question. Because due to both global and localized climate change, women are having to walk further and further for those resources. And if you layer that, we're talking about those layers of oppression and layers of pressures. If you layer that into an area that is already experiencing, for example, conflict, I'm thinking specifically of some of these issues, farmer and herder kind of issues, or issues between villages or communities, even issues of kidnapping for ransom. All of this, the longer that they are out away from their community, that they are potentially by themselves, all increase their vulnerability to a physical attack. But in addition, it also decreases the time that they have to work or seek education outside the home. So that long-term structural inconsistencies and insecurities that they have. So women who are having to walk for water twice a day aren't able to also walk to the market to sell maybe some handmade goods that they had, that they make out of, you know, straw or whatever they have around, and they are able to make a little bit of side income. They are not able to take advantage of those opportunities. Similarly, if your family needs water and the mother can only walk once a day, then you need someone else to walk the second time, you're most often going to choose the girl child and pull them out of school. And so long term, this is affecting literacy rates of women all over the world who are being pulled out of school, not only because their family can't afford the tuition, for example, but also because the family needs them at home to assist with the cooking and the water and the energy resources collections. Stacked on top of that, as you noted, there are issues with, for example, lung cancer coming from standing over charcoal fires or natural gas fires for long hours. It's really hard to cook over an open fire. It takes a lot longer than cooking on my stove, for example. So these things end up taking a much longer time. Your women are standing over these stoves for a much longer time. They are often in charge of also washing clothing, which they are going maybe to a fresh water source. And that source is potentially Uh, dirty, for lack of a better word. I was contaminated. Contaminated is the word I was looking for. With cholera or any host of parasites. So you see women being more likely to get these kinds of parasites, and whether that is manifesting as an illness such as like something like dysentery or diarrhea. Or skin lesions on their hands from washing clothing. You see all of these things happening more to women than to men. On the reproductive side of things, and all of these things are interlaced with poverty, of course. If you have an area where you are struggling to afford food, and there's only one doctor in the area, it's probably going to be very expensive. And if you don't have the money for food, you don't have the money for something like prenatal care. If you are spending 3 hours walking for water and firewood, you don't have time to also walk an hour to go to the doctor. So all of these things compounding with time and poverty, as well as localized climate change, where you are having to walk further or spend more time on things like food and food, water, and energy resources. Really, not to get too deep in the weeds, but something like really poor cuts of meat. They take forever to cook down, right? So you have to spend a lot more time cooking a bad cut of meat to make it palatable than a good cut of meat. So all of these things take time away from women to do other things, and that includes going to the doctor. And if they're and in these many of these areas where people are living on subsistence farming, or if they are living in informal housing in an urban area, access to medical care is already very difficult in terms of time and getting to the doctor, and that is n before even accounting for the cost of a doctor. So, what we're seeing is women who are not able to access things like birth control, even if they want it, which is a whole nother issue of being able to access birth control, right? Being able to access abortions, or having to, or instead trying to induce their own abortions through a variety of means, and that are variety of levels of safe for the woman and her long-term health. We are also seeing women not getting the same kind of routine care, so things like pap smears or breast exams that could pick up an issue that is easily or more easily addressed at an earlier stage, and they're not being able to take that kind of preventative care that would then that leads them to then not discover that they have cancer until it is too late to treat. So we are all of these things are focused on both poverty and time, both, I guess, financial poverty and time poverty that women are facing that is compounded by issues of climate change.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much actually for actually taking us through those nuances, where there are, it's so important to actually unpack and go through those layers to be actually able to comprehend and grasp, the kind of vulnerability that that women and young girls may face. But because we also look at gender-based violence in terms of the vulnerability faced by transgender communities, people from LGBTQI, community. And since you specialize in looking at conflict areas, do you think that this interconnection, this relation, or this understanding between gender-based violence and climate change can also be seen through the intersectionality perspective? Do you have some observations in terms of how the intersectionality and power hierarchy perhaps may define, determine, the level of vulnerability?
Yeah, so I can definitely speak to some of the vulnerabilities that are faced by communities, both the LGBT community as well as something like ethnic minorities and people with disabilities. And in this circumstance, what we see is when there are people who are insecure in their food, water, and energy resources, that leaves them open to fear and manipulation, because of the psychological toll of having to meet those food needs for both yourself and your family. And especially because climate change is a household discussion for most, for many people, and most countries these days. Even if you aren't using the phrase climate change, anyone who works on the land is knows that there's, you know, there are things happening that are different than when their parents were planting. What we do see is people who are taking advantage of this situation and using this as an opportunity to manipulate people into fear-based decisions. And in that way, they're using this kind of systemic pressure to convince people through fear-based tactics, which is something that we see very often in especially genocidal situations, but conflict and war in general, that they need to take a protective or a strike-first kind of situation against an ethnic minority or a religious minority who is living in their community. There are often issues where people are, because of that level of fear, they are open to superstitions that may come back up, that during times of prosperity, it is less necessary to be superstitious, but in times of droughts or a, you know, maybe a series of disasters, you start looking around for a reason, and sometimes that reason can be that blame is then placed on people with disabilities or people who are of the LGBT community living among a village or people with disabilities living in a village. And those people are then vulnerable to violence, whether it is direct violence in terms of killing or direct harm, but also long-term violence. Maybe the rest of the village won't sell to that group anymore, or that group is chased out of the village and has to, you know, move to the urban areas, even if they've lived on that land for generations, right? So, or someone who has a disabled child is, you know, told to commit infanticide for the sake of the village, right? Or the sake of the community, because it is that presence in this in many superstitions that there's the presence of this, you know, X, Y, and Z ethnicity, person with disabilities, person with a different sexual orientation or gender identity, who is causing the village to be unlucky. And so we do see this kind of issue manifesting in areas of food, water, and energy resource insecurity, not necessarily due to any innate bigotry or prejudice, but due to fear and manipulation based on this psychological stressor of the potential for starvation, for example.
Okay, yeah, that's a very significant observation to make, that how deprivation and how shortage, you know, actually leads to insecurity, and how that can actually amplify into, you know, alienating and kind of mistreating, and as you're saying, and that may perhaps would could come on the more marginalized sections, you know, of society. Now that we have problematized looking at those intersections, you know, between gender-based violence and climate change. Would you also like to share with us now some of the state intervention or policy intervention? Like, for example, the United Nations says that there should be more and more women leaders, you know, on the climate, working on the climate issue, and also kind of reaching out at the level of community. So some of the examples that you feel, you know, are important, and they can be taken forward.
Yes, I will say we have made strides in including women in this discussion at the highest international levels, but I mean, it's still not enough, right? First of all, you can't just add women, right? The solution is not just like, oh, we'll just add some women and it'll fix it. Right. Yeah. So that is that that's our there's not enough women. And as one of my scholar role models always asks is not just where are the women, but why are the women there? Who put them there? And what do they think about being there, right? So it's not just adding women, but it's adding effective people who can make change and who can also bring new ideas to the way that we are trying to make effective change. Because, you know, Angela Merkel, for example, is an incredible leader, but she's not necessarily making climate strides simply because she's a woman, right? So it's not just this idea that we need more women. It's for me is that we need better ideas. And right now, what I have seen on the highest levels, you know, the Davos, the UN, the you know, COP, we're trying to science our way out of this. And the countries and the ideas that got us into this aren't going to get us back out. Another role model, Audre Lorde, the master's tools cannot dismantle the master's house. We cannot simply regurgitate the same ideas and the same processes that got us into this to get us out of this. And we need to bring in the people who are affecting change. And right now, that is women at the grassroots level. That is women who are investigating new seed hybrids and are trying to work with their communities to figure out water shortage, you know, new methods of irrigation to in their localized areas. We know from you know, from our scientific records that the world is made up of a series of climatic zones, right? So if we can connect people who are coming up with localized solutions in similar climatic zones, then we can bring and upscale those grassroots solutions from somewhere, you know, in Peru to somewhere in Kazakhstan, who may both be experiencing high drought, mountainous farm issues, right? So what we need to start looking at is thinking outside of our white Western capitalist box and start bringing in the ideas that people are making work. And whether that looks like things like seed hybrids, and I'm not thinking of Monsanto level GMOs. What I'm thinking of is seed hybrids that are still able to reproduce, right? So many of the issues with our genetically modified seeds is that they cannot reproduce themselves, and so people are forced to get seeds to buy seeds again every year instead of being able to bring their to reseed their own farms. So things like reseeding heirloom seeds, things that were probably, you know, that were bred out after during colonialism, things that we can look at different livestock breeds, you know, what kind of animals are thriving in the deserts of Mongolia that could be thriving in the deserts of the Sahara. That is a vast temperature difference, but they're both desert zones, for example. That kind of communication and idea building is, I think, the direction that we need to go. And for many of these spaces, women are the leaders in this thought zone because women are, as we started the conversation with, responsible for these food resources. So even though they may not have the social capital or they may not have the formal education, many of them have been trained by their mothers. They have been taught by the other women in the village. They talk to other women as they are walking to get water. They are problem solving at home with what they have. And we need to look at that and start figuring out how we can build on that instead of replacing that. And I think that that is that would be the start. You know, and of course, I can't, you know, n not shout out to another one of my role models, Wangari Maathai, who knew that if we just start planting trees, this can only lead to good things. So replanting trees, reforestation is a huge aspect of this conversation, not only because of their carbon capture abilities, but because of their long-term health of an ecosystem in a forest is vastly different from an ecosystem in desertification. And if we can start reforesting areas and leave things like virgin forests alone, we are going to be vastly better off because those virgin forests have, for in addition to carbon capture that goes well beyond their canopy level into the soil and peat levels, we are also looking at things like virgin forests have ecosystems that we don't even fathom. Things like mushroom structures and tree root structures that are able to talk to each other and share water systems. Things that we don't know yet. And so if we are disturbing those virgin forests and thinking, oh, we'll just replant them, that's not going to work. That's not the way virgin forests work. So if we can leave those that we haven't yet disturbed, start replanting the ones that we have already disturbed, and start rebuilding some of our overall forest levels in the world. And this is not going to solve climate change, right? But it is a significant way of solving localized climate change, or at least contributing to a solution for localized climate change, and it creates jobs. So if this is something that is, for example, funded by Western countries who are responsible for 99% of climate change, then they can help reforest the countries that are mostly ex who are experiencing 99% of the issues of climate change.
Okay. Thank you very much for actually again bringing out some of the nuances in terms of how what will actually perhaps may not work is some kind of a top-down approach, but rather building on indigenous, local, community-based, you know, understanding of how to maintain the ecosystem. And you know, when we look at India, you know, there was a very famous Chipko movement that happened in 1970s, and I'm not sure if you're aware, but it was had to.
You invented the phrase tree huggers.
Yes, thank you. So where because women were directly gonna, you know, be impacted by the cutting down of the trees. So one of the things you know, that they actually were, they just hugged the trees and therefore, you know, did not let them, you know. So I think what I was trying to understand and perhaps ask you, that do you think the environmental movement, especially at community level, that, you know, is able to at least, you know, kind of push some boundaries and perhaps is able to create awareness, bring together community? And like I said, we do have examples from India. Do you feel that that is the kind of intervention that in the long run perhaps could be more useful in terms of, you know, responding to the state and responding to the international kind of capitalism, you know, that comes in within? So do you think that could be one way of responding and addressing it?
Absolutely. I think one of the issues with the environmental movement as it currently stands, and I have published on this issue, as have many, many authors of color, is that the environmental justice or the environmental movement is plagued by the same issues of everything in the United States, which was that, you know, it comes from a white supremacist background because it comes from a white supremacist society. And I don't think that there is intentional conscious white supremacy in the environmental movement, but there is all of the systemic issues of white supremacy manifest in the environmental movement. And this was something that was well noted in the 80s and 90s as the environmental movement in the United States was growing, that there, you know, that the all of the leadership of these, you know, major environmental companies and organizations were all white. And you know, just as I noted previously, if you are coming up with the same ideas from the same places, you know, if all of the leaders of the oil companies went to Yale and all of the leaders of the environmental organization also went to Yale, we're not getting the freshest ideas, right? No shade to Yale. But what the issue is the regurgitation of the same kinds of solutions. So what we have seen in the last two decades is the recognition of the leadership of people of color and communities of color who are working on indigenous leadership methods and have been working on environmental justice, whether it's under that name or another name, for centuries, of course. And as you noted, the Chapada movement, who, you know, became the first tree huggers. That's one of my favorite pictures, is the women encircling the tree. And what we have seen is the growth of the environmental justice movement, and more globally, the growth of the climate justice movement, which is recognizing the need for Western countries, especially United States, Great Britain, Germany, and to a lesser extent, China and India, to start reducing their carbon emissions, and to pay, for lack of a better word, reparations to the rest of the world for the damage they've caused. And so what we need to see is an increased recognition of the leadership of the rest of the world in this movement, because it's not that they aren't leading. It's not that they aren't, they don't have the capacity or the knowledge or the solutions. It's that a lot of times people won't get out of the way. Right? We see like all the private planes come to Davos. And it's like, what are you doing? So I love some of the unifications of the countries of the global South. Fiji, for example, has been an incredible leader in the islands of, you know, the small island nations groups that are working together because their islands are going underwater. And they have a huge stake in this conversation. And so they are finding a way to have their voice heard. So I think what we are seeing is a recognition and hopefully only increasing of the environmental justice movements, the climate justice movements that are being led by people who have a huge stake in this issue. You know, the environmental justice movement in the US started in North Carolina and Warren County with a community of color who recognized that they didn't want a landfill in their community. And recognizing that all of a sudden, you know, they did one, you know, they're doing these studies that, oh, yeah, landfills do tend to be in communities of color in the United States. Like, so once we start recognizing these systemic issues and these kinds of overarching pressures of that are contributing to both global and localized climate change, then we can start listening more to the people who have solutions or who are noting these issues, like Fiji, like the people of Warren County, North Carolina, like the people of Flint, Michigan, who keep telling us that there's a problem, and we are not fixing it. All of these people have solutions, right? They have a problem and they have ideas. And if we don't start figuring out how to listen better and how to incorporate their ideas into the solution structure, we are losing a whole opportunity for solution building. All right. If we only come up with solutions from one track instead of coming for solutions from two or three tracks, we're losing two or three tracks of possible solutions. And I think, you know, that does come down, of course, to that history of the way our institutions are built, on formal education, on white supremacy, on patriarchy, on capitalism. But we know that, and we can start breaking down those structures and start breaking down those barriers if we want to. And that is, I think, the next step here is recognizing what's at stake and who it and who is at stake for this, right? Who's most at stake, and start listening to broad-based solutions.
I think what you just said in last 5 minutes actually brings down to the essence of, you know, what we call it, our organization as the collaborative social change, right? So unless there is very syncretic positive collaboration, which is going beyond, you know, individual interest and actually, you know, a larger interest, and you know, for the climate, for environmental justice, for, you know, for women and young girls, for their future, you know, as we are looking at, I think that is required. Thank you so much for very patiently taking me and, you know, our audience today through these nuances, through these layers, which are very important to understand, because one thing that goes with the climate change is the fact that, oh, it's not happening to me. It's there. It's out there. For the longest time, that was our approach. It's out there. But I don't think it's out there anymore for anyone. You know, it's right here, and we are facing the implications. My just last question would be as to how, where are you going further with your research? How do you look, what are the questions that now you are exploring and you want to take the debate further with that?
Well, right now I am exploring the concept of structural atrocity prevention. So one of the things we talked about is the aspects of the fear and manipulation that allow communities to scapegoat a certain population. And so one of the things that I'm very interested in is the concept of within this concept of structural atrocity prevention, which is, you know, the idea that if you are you take basically reduce the amount of pressures, those, you know, those layered pressures, if you can start to address some of those layered pressures, that the choice of conflict or violence is reduced, right? The option for choosing violence is less attractive for a population for a variety of reasons. And so what I'm looking at is addressing climate change as a form of structural atrocity prevention. So by finding ways to reduce the food, water, and energy resource insecurity, we are able to reduce the likelihood that a community will cause or participate in an identity-based conflict. So what I'm exploring right now is kind of how that looks on the ground, if that is something that's possible, if that's something that is more, it's fairly theoretical right now, but it manifests on the ground, as we were talking about, in localized ways of understanding how different communities understand conflict, and how they understand risk, and then starting to navigate the ways that they are facing food, water, and energy resource insecurity, as a method for increasing the peacefulness in their communities.
Thank you so much, Emily. I think what your research is doing is something which is very significant. Bringing these keywords together for us, where we are looking at, as we just discussed, looking at the future of our young girls, of women, and then how it is actually about their just basic right to dignity, their right to be, to live with dignity, to live with aspirations, to live with dreams. And live fully. I think at the end of the day, that's what we are talking about. So thank you so much for that very in-depth and, as I said, very patiently taking us through those nuances. Those are very important. These are very important questions and important issues in contemporary times, because they are manifesting in different forms, and it is very important to kind of address them, in the way, that you have been and other scholars and other activists have been doing. So thank you so much, Emily, for being with us today at Collaborative Social Change on this podcast series on gender-based violence context and contestations. And we hope to have maybe again sometime later, where you can share your new research and new, kind of work with us. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you so much. It was absolutely my pleasure.